Up next, time to talk baseball. In the 1960s, as we're joined by John Florio, co-author with Wheezy Shapiro of a terrific book, One Nation Under Baseball, How the 1960s Collided with the National Pastime. John, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rich.
Man, it was such a crazy, turbulent decade, and those changes reflected or carried on by baseball, and changes in race relations, labor relations, and even changes in the media. And I was fascinated to read about how media coverage of baseball changed during this decade, thanks to that group known affectionately and perhaps derisively by some as the Chipmunks.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when we sat down, when Wheezy and I sat down and started writing this book, it actually started with us looking at Jim Boughton's Ball 4, which really is what I would imagine some of your listeners know. But Boughton's book at the end of the 70s was a real game changer. I mean, no pun intended, but it was telling stories about what was going on in the locker room. It was a real look inside baseball. And at the beginning of the decade, it wasn't like that. You know, you had reporters were kind of building the myth around players like Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris and these heroes. And somewhere through the 60s, we said to ourselves, well, what were the things that led up to Boughton? What was the perfect storm, you know, that allowed that book to even be published? Because he had stories in there about the Yankees, you know, looking into windows, peeping Toms on the top of the roof of the Sherman Hotel in Washington, D.C. How did that even get published at the time? And then we started looking at the arc of the 60s and how we went from the myth building to the tearing down of the myth with Boughton. And right in the middle there was a group of sports writers called the Chipmunks. And a lot of those were afternoon guys in the newspapers. You know, the morning guys were reporting the scores of the game. This guy got a base hit, so-and-so crossed the plate. All of a sudden, you had afternoon guys, and they had to fill the papers with something. They started telling stories about the players themselves, what it was like off the field, what they were doing at home. What, you know, this guy played for his father. This guy was playing for his mother, who was watching him in a hospital room, whatever it happened to be. And that started paving the way, along with a lot of other things in culture and society. But that started paving the way for a book like Boughton's to come. So in those 10 years, you really saw a shift, a seismic shift in the way the game was covered.
And Jim Boughton wasn't the only ball player that was writing about this. I thought the story of Jim Brosnan was fascinating.
Yeah, well, you know, Brosnan was really the first. You know, I mentioned that Boughton was the first, and that's not really true. Brosnan, at the beginning of the decade, had written two books about what it was like to be a baseball player. But his, you know, he was taking heat for just saying, after the game, I like to go home and drink a martini, which maybe you could look at as the beginning of it, but was still very innocuous. It was not really what we saw like happening by the end of the decade. And actually, when I spoke about that book, we were thinking of originally our first idea. We were talking about Boughton. We were going to cover the arc from Brosnan to Boughton. You know, that was the first, you know, bang against the door. And then, you know, Ball 4 came along and just was the battering ram that opened it up.
And, of course, baseball right on the forefront of what was going on in the civil rights movement. And it's hard to imagine it even from 50-plus years out. But to think of the fact that the Yankees didn't add a black player until, what, 56 with Elston Howard, the Red Sox 59 with Pumpsy Green, and that as the book begins and as the decade begins, these players are still dealing with huge levels of segregation, Jim Crow laws, particularly during spring training.
Yeah, you know, that was very interesting to us. When the book came out, younger readers were saying to us, you know, they didn't realize that the game was still so segregated in the 60s. I mean, the idea, you know, the legend is that, I mean, it is true. I shouldn't say legends, but the common belief is that Jackie Robinson integrated the game, and he did by breaking the color barrier. But the teams and the leagues, there was still segregation going on, and Jim Crow laws when they went south. So when they played in spring training down in Florida in the 60s, players who were used to integrate, even some didn't, but some that were living in integrated cities in the north, when they went down south, were playing during spring training, they were in a segregated situation. They had no idea to expect it. You know, to one of the guys we speak about is Bill White, who was from a more integrated area in Ohio. He went down and realized, wow, Jim Crow laws here in the South are still going on. And they had to deal with that all through spring training. So the book opens up, you know, we see guys like Hank Aaron, Bill White, Bob Gibson. I mean, major stars, not that it's right for anybody, but major stars being separated from their team after the game, going to have to live in special housing, and a lot of times not being able to find it.
Hi, this is Bruce John. One of the questions, one of the things that Rich just brought up is with the civil rights movement in baseball, it seems to me it was the first sport of all the sports where the political cause of civil rights and an owner and a player all seem to mesh to come together, so that we think of the incident with Curt Flood, his issues, and with Jackie Robinson, all that, all being a natural part of a movement. Is that true, mm-hmm. or is that really overstating it and sort of saying that maybe society changed?
Well, you know, I think it's a great question. I appreciate it. I think that there's a lot of truth in it. But what we did when we wrote the book was to try to figure out whether baseball was ahead or behind of the curve. And we had a huge board. We had all these little sticky notes up, and we started writing. And this started, you know, this is how it grew from being just about publishing into about a race and all the things that happened in the 60s. We started putting up all the different events, kind of like a timeline, and it felt a little like a push-me, pull-me. You know, it seemed like baseball started out and was pushing things, and then it would kind of stop and then wait, and society would pass it a bit, and then it would catch up and go ahead, and then it would stop, and society would move forward. So in some ways, it's a chicken and egg thing. Was it keeping up with society, or was it pulling society? I think it was a little bit of both. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, a real sea change in labor relations took place. It started, as you point out in the book, with the twin holdouts of Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax, but then what really changed the playing field was the hiring of Marvin Miller, a guy who should be in the Baseball Hall of Fame, who finally in early 68 got not just the first collective bargaining agreement in Major League Baseball, but in pro sports.
Yeah, well, you know, he was not actually the owner's first choice. We speak about that whole negotiation of bringing him in. He was from the Steelworkers Union. He knew unionization. He actually had a tough time convincing the players to vote for him. Many of them voted, but some of them felt that, you know, unions were a dirty word. So he, and a lot of it was being fed by the owners telling the players, you know, unionization, it's not something that's really going to help you. So there was a lot of fear that if the players were able to, a lot of it went back to the language of their contract and the reserve clause, where before Marvin Miller came along, players basically were owned by their teams. You know, it was a language that could be interpreted a couple of ways, but the way it was being interpreted was, if you played, like back in the day, like let's say Tony Oliva was playing for the Twins, he was going to have to play for the Twins the following year, or he wouldn't be in baseball at all. He wasn't able to go from team to team. So when Marvin Miller was explaining to players, you know, we want to challenge that, we want to, you know, players to be able to go from team to team, which is ultimately what Curt Flood, the big, at the end of the decade, what Curt Flood was fighting for. Some players said, well, won't the teams with the money get all the good players? And what Marvin Miller pointed out to them was, well, it's happening now anyway. It happens through trades. It happens through scouting. It happens a lot of different ways. It's not going to change the playing field that much. You know, of course, history has gone on, and we've seen free agency did change the game quite a bit. But Miller had a point. You know, it wasn't like it only started with free agency that the bigger market teams were getting the best players. It was there were other ways they were getting it before that, through recruitment, through scouting. You know, the Kansas City, the A's were in a lot of ways a feeding system for the Yankees. They would bring players up. The Yankees would trade for them and bring them over to New York.
We're looking throughout the spring and summer back at 1968 on this 50th anniversary, and that was a remarkable year in baseball and, of course, in society. And the assassinations, first in April of Martin Luther King Jr., then in June of Bobby Kennedy, impacted a number of players. But it seems like none were more impacted and affected than Bob Gibson, who took that anger about those assassinations and everything else that was going on and channeled that into one of the greatest seasons any pitcher has ever had.
Somehow, he was able to take that anger and put it into athletic performance. You know, we spoke with Tim McCarver about Gibson, and he said, you know, the amazing thing about 68 was not only did his anger put it make him hyper-focused, he said his control was unbelievable. He said, you know, you would think somebody who's that angry would lose their control. He said, but he was able to throw within, I think he said, like one baseball's width of wherever he put the catcher's mitt. It was going to be, so whatever a baseball is, let's say it's like, I don't know, 3.5 inches, whatever it is, that was how close he would come to hitting the target every time the entire season. So it was amazing that he was able to do that, to throw with the heat and to throw with the command, what we call today command, but back then was called control, to be able to do that for such an extended period of time. But, you know, it's interesting, we wrote a piece recently, Weezy and I wrote a piece recently for ESPN's The Undefeated, and it's a story we touch upon in the book of when King was assassinated, that baseball was one of the few sports, it was right before opening day, baseball was one of the few sports that didn't stop play to honor King, at least not officially. The commissioner at the time, Eckert, left it up to the teams, and to make a long story shorter, it ended up being the Pirates who really led the charge, saying we're not going to take the field. And then after they did it, other teams fell in line. The Pirates, of course, back then were the most integrated team in the league. So there was still that kind of, this goes back to the question before from Bruce, whether baseball was ahead or behind. You know, in that instance, baseball was behind the other sports. They weren't doing anything. King was assassinated. They were ready to go out and play. Then they said, all right, we'll play. We'll take off the first day, but the second day of the season is the day of the funeral. We'll play that day. Then they got pushed back on that, and they said, all right, well, the West Coast teams, the minute the funeral's over, the West Coast teams can take the field because they'll be playing later in the day after the interment. And eventually the Pirates took the stand. Other teams fell in line, the Astros being one of them, but other teams fell in line. So while baseball was ahead of the curve in some ways, they were behind on other things.
Another pitcher who dominated that year and very different than Bob Gibson was, of course, Denny McClain, who won 31 games for the Tigers. Loved the spotlight, anything he could get out of it. And so many great stories in the book, from his pitching while hungover at the All-Star game to his drinking of 24 Pepsis a day to playing as an organist and then grooving one to Mickey Mantle for home run number 535.
Well, you know what? What was so great about that showdown was that you really had two such opposite guys, Bob Gibson and Denny McClain, in the World Series. I mean, Bob Gibson, you know, did not want the spotlight. If anything, he was away from it, was you know, pissed at the what was going on with the assassinations. McClain, on the other hand, is loving the limelight. He is a complete opposite. He's a, you know, a talkative guy. He talks with the media. He loves the media. He sits around for hours with them. He has them over to his house for parties when he's playing the organ. So Gibson, a complete athlete, really watching his body and working out. McClain drinking 24 Pepsis a day. So you have two guys who are really opposite, and then they, you know, they come together in the World Series, which is just, you know, it's the stuff that, you know, sports writers dream about, because you have such two strong forces coming together like that. But you mentioned the story of McClain. He had already made 30 games. He's in first place. The Yankees are out of it at this point. And he knows that Mantle wants to catch Jimmy Fox. Everybody's been hanging on this. You know, he needs one more homer to catch Jimmy Fox before he retires. Everybody knows he's going to retire. And McClain tells the catcher, calls out the catcher, says, tell Mantle I'm going to groove one. So he throws one right down. The catcher does it, tells Mantle, and then McClain grooves one. Mantle doesn't swing. He does it again. He throws a second. He grooves it. And he calls the catcher out. He goes, what the hell's going on? He goes, well, Mantle wants to know if you really mean it. He goes, yes, I really mean it. I just threw him two meatballs. So finally he turns to Mantle. He goes, Mick, where do you want it? So Mantle shows him, puts his hand out, like right here. And McClain throws it there. And Mantle, you know, hits his homer and catches Fox. And they interviewed Gibson afterwards. And they said, what do you think of that? And Gibson said, you can respect the guy all you want, but what I would have done is I would have thrown a high, hard one. I'm not going to give in to anybody. And that gives you an idea of the difference between these two guys and how they handle themselves. And, you know, it's both of them are great. It's just fantastic to have watched the two of them go head to head.
It really is a tremendous book. One Nation Under Baseball, How the 1960s Collided with the National Pastime, John Florio and Wheezy Shapiro. John, thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rich. It's a pleasure.